13 stitches
to a bag.
You cannot be serious.
She's always good at it.
Don, we're on. Might have to edit out you swearing. Don't rip the thing over like that.
Is this close enough?
We've got the cadence bars going here, Larry, so we'll be able to tell Don's a master at not speaking into the microphone. Okay. So, we're about to start. Well done. No, it's all right. You can keep doing it. Now, Don, we'll just say straight off the top, we've got Larry Perkins in. Larry Perkins, who is a star Australian sports person, sports man.
His body language is not good.
Pardon?
His body language.
Well, no one will see that, Don. Oh, we're doing a podcast. It's not a visual medium. It's just audio.
Cameras.
Now, Larry Clifton Perkins, AM.
Clifton.
AM.
AM.
Yeah, means he gets up early in the morning.
Does he?
I think that's what AM means. Or is it an Australian medal?
It's a medal from recipient. Australia.
He's a former racing driver and V8 supercar owner. He has won more Bathursts than you've had hot breakfasts. He's been a Formula One driver overseas. He's been a mechanic. He's owned teams. He's got a son that drives. He had a father, a brother. A father? I'm going to ask him. Someone who discovered...
Would have had a father.
I think his father discovered some artifacts that were left by the early settlers. And Larry came upon them in the Simpson Desert. We'll ask him about that. Now, I know. You've done no research at all. You're looking at me with those stupid grin on your face. You've got no idea who he is or what you're going to ask him. Well, you know who he is, but you've done no research. And this is what
it doesn't interest me, right, motor racing.
Oh, well, that's good, Don. Well, that's fantastic. That's made him feel at home. We had Peter Brock's Mick Hone in. Yeah. You asked him questions.
I've got a lot of questions to ask, Larry.
Larry, welcome to You Cannot Be Serious. Now, thank you very much for doing this. I asked you to come in as a result of going to a pre-Grand Prix, Melbourne Grand Prix function run by, I think, the VACC, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And there was a panel up there, and you were fantastic because you spoke about car racing and Formula One and the teams and the engines that are in the cars, gave me information I never knew in the first place, and I'm quite a devotee of car racing. I used to go out to Calder all those years ago and watch Norm Beachy and Gagan, Beachy, Moffat.
Bob Jane.
Jane, you. You might have been, they might have preceded you. I'm not sure about that. We'll ask you that. But anyhow, and I thought we'll get you in and have a chat to, you can have a chat to us because I've seen you in socially, not socially, but I've seen you out and about and you're a very interesting man. So welcome and thank you for coming.
Oh, my pleasure, and thank you. Nice to meet you, Don, as well, over there. And it was a small drive down from the farm to get here, only 550K, but
you've driven. Hang on, woo. You've driven down this morning to do this podcast.
No, I came.
No, you yet. Should have said yes.
I came down yesterday.
Should have made us feel important.
Well, I am complimented that you drive. Well, I wouldn't do it, but thank you very much for coming. He's come all. Where's your farm?
Yeah, up in the Mallee and the good part of the Mallee.
Is there a good part? Is there a good part of the Mallee?
The middle, yeah.
Don, he's domiciled in Melbourne. He has a property up where you said, but he hasn't come down specifically. We've tried to coordinate his appearance on You Cannot Be Serious with him coming to Melbourne, Don. Do you think he drove 550 kilometres down here just to speak to you and me?
Larry,
come on,
Larry! I have
step up, mate.
I have followed motor racing to a small degree, and what fascinates me about you is that you switch from Formula One to road and or V8s or whatever else. Is there a difference between the cars? And I know there's a difference, but as far as driving the things are concerned,
Well, tremendous difference. Yeah, Formula One, and this you've cranked in my old memory cells. I left the farm when I was 19 to go Formula One racing, which is the king of the castle. Like touring cars was second rate. And you mentioned, you know, interviews with others, Peter Brock and so on. And I knew those guys way back in 1970. And I said, why are you staying in Australia to be king of the kids? I'm going for the bloody big goal. And so I went to Europe and...
You won the Formula 3 championship over in Europe?
Yes, that's right. I mean, I got to Europe by winning the Formula Ford championship, which is a junior category in Australia. But that had a prize of two business class tickets to Europe. And I got my car to compete in a world final at Brands Hatch, the most famous racetrack in the world back then. So as a result of all that and further actions, I got into Formula One. Sam just said, I won the Formula 3 European Championship, it was called then, because there is no world championship. And that effectively got me into Formula One.
So how did you finance it? Because me, I've been to Sandown and I was fascinated by what's behind the infrastructure.
For a man who's not interested in car racing.
Shut up, will you? How did you finance it, or did you have a backer?
Well, I didn't finance it, and that was always a problem. I said I won two business class tickets, so I converted one to cash, and then I downgraded the business class back to way down the back cattle class. That gave me more money I'd seen in my life. So I was running hand to mouth in Europe all those days. I had a truck, which carted my... I bought a cheap truck, Bedford, funny enough, and lived in the truck and wandered around from circuit to circuit in Europe, picking up appearance money.
You did the work on the truck, the car. So you must be you're not a dummy. You've got to be a bit of an engineer.
I'm a windmill mechanic.
A what?
I'm a windmill mechanic. I left school very early on and. Drove tractors and things like that. When I was driving tractors when I went to school at 13 because I could make money and I wanted to make money. And that's why I went to Europe. I wanted all the trappings that I could see Formula One had. I wanted, I don't know what the order was. Was it fancy cars and fancy girlfriends or the other way around? And that looked to me was what Europe was all about. And
how did you go with the girlfriends?
Well, that remains in the sealed packet at the moment, yeah.
Oh, I see.
So, Larry, with the great billion-dollar teams of today like Red Bull and Mercedes, there's been a few casualties in the modern era like Jaguar and Force India, and they just can't measure up. But when you started in Formula One, you were with... four or five different teams. Amon, what's Board and who's
BR Borrow?
Borrow, sorry, Amon, Borrow, Brabham, BRM, and Surtees. How did you get? You were well sought after, I presume, after you won the Formula 3 championship, and they said to you, Larry, you better come and drive for us. Tell us some experiences with those five different sides, the teams that you drove for.
Well, the first one was the Amon team, and I'd been in Europe 2 years only, and Chris Amon, a New Zealander who never won a world championship but is a fantastic driver, was going out on his own. And he had a good friend, a journalist, David Mackay, and David said to him, hey, you got to keep an eye on this LP bloke from the Mallee. And so Chris was financed by others and wanted me then to drive his second car. So I thought, well, this is pretty cool. I'm in Formula One, been only Europe 2 days, and I haven't had the...
And it was called money. It's called Amon.
Well, it was called Formula, Amon, from Chris Amon's name. But the financiers all... went south after a very short amount of time, and I got to only do one entry to a Grand Prix, which is the Nürburgring Grand Prix, the famous Nürburgring,
famous,
15 miles around, I think it was, and 185 corners and so on. And I never qualified because the car, I backed it into the wall when I went over a hill in the rain, and the wall was... harder than the back suspension of the car, and we had no spares, blah blah. So I never got to ever race it, and the team folded relatively short time after that. I then had to go back to soul searching, what do I do now? And that's when 1975 came along, and I won the European Championship with Ron Turinac, who was the partner of Jack Brabham. Ron rang me up one day and said, "Hey, I'm starting building race cars again, and they're going to be called Routes. And, you know, can we do a deal somehow?" I said, "Well, I've got a truck, and I can get free engines off a company in Italy who promised me engines." And he said, "Well, I'll build the car." So I was his first employee. He rang me up, and I went down to his warehouse, and I painted the walls and pulled all the nails out. And because Ron was a frugal sort of bloke, and he appreciated that I was a hands-on bloke. And being a mechanic all my life, yeah, it was no big deal for me to, you know, put the plumbing right or put airlines in a factory. And so anyway, he made the first Routes car. He then, Racing Routes, ended up being the biggest manufacturer of race cars in Europe at the time.
Yeah.
Making about, I think we're up around 100 a year almost, yeah.
So Larry, you're a bit like Niki Lauda, who, when he got his first drive, he insisted on telling the people how the car should be set up as opposed to just driving it. You're an engineer, aren't you? You're a Perkins Engineering was one of your teams, the Holden dealer team, is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
So you're being a bit modest about you could set the car up, and you're a bit like Lauda, as in being able to set the car up and say what you wanted rather than the owners saying how the car should be, as opposed to James Hunt, who just got there and drove it and went out with all the girls.
I don't know, his model might have been better than mine. But you're right, I was always very much hands-on. I mean, anything a mechanic can do, I could arguably do better. And
Hang on, to be an engineer requires, to me, goes to university or something. You're a self kind of...
Well,
self-taught, are you?
Well, I went to the better university, and that's the one of Hard Knocks, and I was very successful in that. And but my dad, who did his time in the 30s as a car mechanic before he joined the Air Force in 1939, 1940, and then he was an aircraft
mechanic,
engine fitter.
Same as my father.
He ended up a sergeant in there. The farm way back then was only 1 square mile. And when Dad came back from the Air Force, he made money, not much money, but he made money by fixing everyone else's machinery. And me being part of the four sons, you know, had to go along and helping him. So Dad was fastidious in his own engineering, and his training was, you know, the top of the tree. So I learned everything about engineering
from
Dad. It's as simple as that.
So you still have to have a basic knowledge of cylinders and shock absorbers. So you can't just you must have studied it pretty diligently.
Well, I just paid attention, and you know, so when I got to Europe at 19, I'm racing guys who are 20 in Formula 3, and then I was amazed to find out that, you know, I've been working 8 or 9 years and they're still at uni. I thought, Jesus Christ, I'm so far ahead of you guys. This is something you
couldn't In what way were you in front of them?
Well, I knew what was going on with the car.
Yeah, right.
And I could see if a mechanic did a good job or a bad job. And I then in Formula One, with those various teams Sam mentioned, I had 8 DNFs, as in did not finish the race. Right. 99% of them were due to mechanics doing a crap job.
Right.
So you are absolutely parallel to Lauda. That was exactly what Lauda did when he started.
He had a grandfather that owned the Bank of Austria.
No, besides the money, but he knew exactly how the car should be set up and how he wanted it, and you did that as well.
Correct. I knew exactly what I wanted to do with the car, and when I worked in the Formula 3 category with Ron Turinac when I won the championship, Ron was you still need an engineer to give you a version of, and then someone has to adjust the car. In this case I adjusted it, but Ron and I worked together very well because Ron, he was the engineer and made the Brabham team won 3 world championships.
So Brabham, it was genius?
Brabham was also
just put the money
very
up.
Similar to me. But yeah, if you can work with an engineer, and I worked, and both Jack and I then worked with Ron Turinac. And he was, you know, he would extract the information out of you if... It's a team. It's you work together. I say, hey, Ron, it's, you know, spinning the wheels at 150 mile an hour or whatever. I think it could be the shockers or it could be, yeah, lots of chat like that. And so, you know, it was a team, ultimately have a team. And, I mean, for sure in my Formula 3 days, I was only a small team, me and a mate and Ron Turanac. But, you know, that's how it is. And you just got to get on with it.
Hey, listen, and I want you, I don't, tell me what qualities you possess, and I don't, you know, that other drivers haven't got if you've gone from Formula 3 up to Formula 1. Now, you must have qualities that other drivers haven't got. Now, I don't wish, you know, tell me what they are, please. What have you got over other drivers? Because you mustn't be a mug driver.
Judgment and gonads.
No, be because I know nothing about this sport.
You got to have an unbelievable desire to be successful.
Mm.
And that, you know...
Yeah, but other qualities come in. Come on, what qualities have you got that others haven't?
I suppose, and time has... others have said, you know, I won't cop a fool badly, very good at all. You know?
What do you mean you're a straight talker?
Well, I say it as it is, and that's...
Yeah, but you haven't got that. What I'm talking about is out on the track itself, the qualities that obviously you've got that others haven't got. Now, what are those on the racetrack?
Judgment and courage.
Judgment's the go. And
what do you mean by judgment?
Well, judgment. Let's say you're doing 200 miles an hour and there's a 50 mile an hour corner coming up. You got to brake for it. Now, a slow driver will put his brakes on, let's say, at 100 yards before the corner, 100 metres before. The physical limits of the car... maybe 55 metres from the corner. I have to make a judgement. Now, do I put the brakes on at 55.3 metres before the corner and just get it? If I put them on at 54 metres, I'm going to hit the wall. And, you know, so it's how close you can push the car to the limit. And you've then got to, you know, if you enter the corner at, you know, the 50-mile-an-hour corner at 52, you're going to crash. If you enter it at 49, you're far too slow because the bloke who enters at 49.99 is going to beat you. And I was on the edge.
And therein is the skill, Larry. Anyone can drive the car at 300 miles an hour, but it's getting around the corners at the right...
So I watched a film with interest. It was about the development of the Shelby car that went to America, and that fellow that wrote, I suppose he's similar to you, he had a feel for the actual driver, and in the way it was portrayed in the film is this bloke had balls and he pushed that car to the limit. I think he got killed in the end, didn't
Carol
he?
Carol Shelby.
Not Carol Shelby, the driver. He was an Englishman.
I'm not sure who you mean, but look.
Well, the driver of the Shelby that went to Le Mans or something.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure.
Played by Christian
Bale.
He was played by Christian Bale. I know who you mean, Don, but I can't think of it.
He pushed that. I don't know whether they're exaggerating in the film, but he really did push that car.
Well, Shelby, I think they probably would be. Yeah,
but what you got to remember, Rambo can't drive a race car very fast at all. Like, it's not a Rambo thing driving a race car. It's judgment. It's judgment and belief in yourself, and then be able to. You know, some cars on the corner I've just described may not be set up correctly. So all the four wheels aren't gripping the corner as well as they could. And if you've got one wheel 10% off the good grip, it won't go through the corner.
So how do you get the good grip?
Well, you've got to feel what the issues are, and you've got suspension and aerodynamics and shock absorbers and power application and gear, what gear, if you're running the right revs, et cetera, et cetera. So all these things come into play, and you've got to have, when you brake, for instance, at this get to the maximum of braking, all four wheels should be slowly turning together. Some corners you may want to arrive there with the back wheels for the last 10 metres locked up, so you effectively do a handbrake turn into this 200-mile-an-hour corner, and all this takes a lot of judgement.
So the technical aids of today's F1 cars are absolutely out of not out of control, but they're beyond whatever you would have ever thought a car could be capable of. Because in your day, you actually had to drive the car, change gears, put your foot on a thing called the clutch, and brake. And but today, I know it's skillful today, but my word, it's different.
It's different, that's for sure. The high G-forces of today, when you're pulling four Gs around the corner, and back in my
What's
time,
four Gs?
Well, four times the gravity. So, you know, when you put the brakes on, they pull five Gs. So your own body is weighing, instead of being 80 kilos, you're 400 kilos. Yep. So that's a much higher number than in my day of racing. In my day, it was probably approaching, get sniffing up towards 2 Gs, which is sort of hardly nothing. But so that's the biggest thing. The rule changes that have allowed these computer aids to come in, I have always been against. I think the driver of these cars should be the driver. Now, the skills I mentioned of how fast you have to approach a corner and when you turn, etc., are just as real today, and you've even got to be quicker because the speeds are massively higher than in my day. Yep. I mean, everywhere you look at a Formula One car, they're doing 250k. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, but they brake a lot quicker and harder.
The grip is
it's
tremendous.
It's sort of relative, isn't it?
It's relative. But the guy who's on the money in Formula One, put aside the fact that he has got some aids from the computer, etc., he's still doing the hard bit. If he approaches a corner that's only good enough for 200 kilometres an hour and he's doing 201, he's going to have a big crash. It's as simple as that.
So tell me about, Larry, the engines, in that chat that you had before the thing, I was staggered that...
Hang on, chat before what thing?
Well, I said I asked Larry to come here because I was at a function before the Grand Prix.
Oh, yeah.
The VACC function.
Right.
And among other things, we were discussing how big the engines are in today's Formula One cars, because in your day they had V12s and turbochargers, and some of the cars had two wheels up the front, like dual wheel steering. Today's, just tell us about today's Formula One car, what the engine, how big the engine is and what it develops.
Well, just quickly, in my time, it was what's called 3-litre formula. No turbocharger or nothing.
Yes.
The 3-litre category, in other words, that's the engine displacement. Today...
Was that a V8 or is it a V6?
Well, in my day, that was V8s. We had flat 12s, the Alfa Romeo. We had V12s, the BRM. So there was no rule.
What horsepower would these engines put out?
Back then, we were producing around 600 horsepower.
Shit.
Now, though, the engines are 1.5 litre.
1.5, that's 1,500 cc's.
Yeah, half your size.
What's that? Okay, tell me what's that in horsepower. That's all
I can
relate
to. Well, at the end of the day, they're producing, and I could be a little bit wrong, but probably not
1,000?
About, 800 or 900 horsepower.
But joking.
They can wind the horsepower up for qualifying because they got the electronic controls on the turbocharger. They're very much turbocharged and what I call it blown to the shithouse, meaning they've got a huge pressure of blowing air into the engine. That's what the turbocharger does.
Shit.
So they can use the computer to just wind up the blow-off valve so you can have a lot more pressure for a little bit of time just to sneak in, the qualifying lap. So they might, I don't know the numbers, because they're very secretive about all this, but they could easily have an extra 100 horsepower.
Geez, I drive a truck, 250 semi, 256 horsepower. I know they get up to 400 and 500, some of the semis, but they're bigger than semi trailers, or their engines are much bigger.
But I haven't mentioned this electric business now. See, these are what are called hybrid engines. So they've got a dirty great battery under the seat there somewhere.
Battery pack, yeah.
Battery pack. And then when they put the brakes on, the rear brakes generate power in a Formula One car.
They recharge the battery.
Recharging the battery. And then when you're going down the straight and you want to, you press a little button and you can get up to another 200 horsepower.
Shit.
Banging into the back wheels for a short period of time.
Wow.
So it's a tremendous difference. All those things are different to my time, but but that's the way it is. And the drivers don't make the rules. Someone else has to drive them.
Now, what about, okay, now you go off to Europe, you're living on the smell of an oily rag. How do you generate, now I've only seen these semis on the road, I go to Queensland, I see them on occasions coming back, they've got these big elaborate, huge semis that have turned out. It must cost a fortune to run a team. How do you generate the money and where does it come from to keep a team on the road?
Well, in Formula One today, the average, if there's such a thing as average, a team of like Ferrari, it's probably the biggest team. It might have 800 employees.
What?
The average team's probably 400 to 500. That's what? Without counting all the contractors of that.
$1 billion a year.
A lot of money.
And so where does the money come from?
Well, the money, I mean, it's such a household name today. I mean, Ferrari's memorabilia, what do you call it?
Merchandise
yep. sales are huge.
Like, huge.
People want to have a Ferrari cap. Now, when you multiply that by the whole world population, it ends up a lot of money and so on. So the money... The money flows into these teams, and they always claim they haven't got enough money, but that's just because when they get it, they spend it. And they've got a thing called a salary cap now, which is the most pathetic thing I've ever heard in my life. I'm just so anti a salary cap that just says you're not allowed to spend more than 140 million euros. But... yeah, it's just a bit of a little game they're playing.
Joke.
To pretend they're being nice.
So, okay, what about the bring it back to Australia, the V8s. How much does it cost to put those teams on the road for the year?
Well, it's around, back in my day, and I sold my team around 2010.
Sold your team?
I sold my team to someone else who wanted to buy it. And that's fine. I had 60 employees and it's no secret.
Was that the Holden dealer team?
Yeah, well, my team was called Perkins Engineering.
Yep.
And the opposition, I was still a privateer, the opposition was the Holden dealer team.
I see, yep.
And they were factory sponsored, et cetera, et cetera.
Yep.
So I had to find, to be able to be competitive with them, I had to have enough money to do all the things you have to do. And so I had to earn that money. And that was a figure of around about 5 million.
What? And a year?
A year. And this is ultimately why I sold my team, because I thought, how am I going to... Yeah, it was stressing me a lot that I had to pay these guys, 60 guys every year. And yep. I didn't have no... Yeah, I didn't choose my parents well at all. They had no money. And
so where did you get your money from?
Well, my model was a bit different because... I had to earn it. So this is why we were Australia's largest maker and seller of V8 supercars. So I sold 49 V8 supercars, which are all still owned by someone today. So I would make a successful car and sell it. That would, if I'd done my sums right, that would finance my own car for the next race and so on. So I had about 60% of my money came from sales that I generated by making gizmos that other people wanted. And
gizmos meaning what? Instruments or
Gizmos meaning suspension parts and body parts and all the things that make a race
was
car
there any
go
jealousy?
Faster.
Hang on. Was there any jealousy if you're selling to competitors that you're not giving them the best and you're keeping the best for yourself?
I wouldn't call it jealousy. I'd call it moaning. There's always
what moaning?
Moaning. Yeah, there's a lot of moaning goes on. I'll give you a quick example. I sold a race car to a bloke. He wanted to buy two race cars and eight engines. I said, yeah, that'll cost you a fair bit. And he said, how will I know that my engines will be as good as yours? I said, well, let's wait till we get to Bathurst and I'll let you choose my engine out of the pool of engines.
Hang on. Yeah, go on.
So 9 months later when we get to Bathurst, I said, hey, Tony, come down and... time to put our race engine in and you've got to pick yours one because I carried his engines. I said, pick your engine and pick mine and you tell me which one's mine.
Tony Longhurst?
It was indeed Tony
yep.
Longhurst.
Yep.
So Tony Longhurst chose, of the three or four engines we had in the truck, chose my engine and he chose his. And so he never whinged after that.
You said that you made money out of making gizmos, I think. Yeah. So one of the intriguing things, you did you not collaborate with Peter Brock to develop a failed system for the... Now, this is what the project was called. It was called the LJ Tirana GTR X6 stroke 1V8 project.
That's an awful lot of letters.
That's what it says in the thing.
Well, that's...
The LJ Tirana GTR X6 stroke 1V8 project. Now, what did you collaborate with him that was failed?
No knowledge of that at all. And I never...
You don't?
I never collaborated with Peter on anything.
Didn't you?
Peter hired me to run his race team, and that contract was a year contract, which went on for 3.5 years. And my contract, which Peter wrote, says, I'm in charge of the race team.
Yep.
And he gave me a budget. Every year I gave him a decent chunk of money back because I was... quite frugal, and we could do the job without spending it all. Only years, I believe, Peter made any money.
So did you get on well with Peter Brock?
I got on fine with Peter.
And he was a star?
Well, we got on fine with Peter because Peter's forte was he was good with the press. He always had good sponsors, etc., and he loved all that. And I didn't like any of that. So my forte was, doing the engineering, which I was very happy with. And it ultimately was my demise because I said to Peter after 3 years, you're not allowed in the workshop anymore. And he obviously didn't like that. This was when the polarizer came on board.
Oh, yeah. And, was that what I was alluding to then?
Probably.
The polarizer.
It could have been the polarizer.
He lost his job. He lost his sponsorship.
Well, he lost
that,
a lot of credibility. It was the bottom line. And
it was crystals or something to make the engine.
It was nonsense. But that was... That was a thing. I just couldn't agree with anything like that.
So you said you didn't like publicity. Is that how? Did that hold you back in the world of car racing? The fact that you didn't promote yourself.
Well, my racing life's Europe and then Australia. In Europe, it really wasn't an issue because over there, anyone who owned a race car wanted the driver. Very few owners were drivers, and they had to find a driver. And all I had to demonstrate was I'm better than anyone else. And so I had drives, But
and so that generated publicity?
No, just being successful on the track.
Generated publicity for you.
No, but Don, being successful on the track is publicity in itself because
correct.
Did you not win Bathurst in 82?
Oh, yeah.
83, 84, 93, 95, 97?
Correct.
So whether you didn't do publicity or not, the very fact that you were a star and led the field, it's a bit like footballers who don't do press, but they are just champion footballers like Gary Ablett Sr. People just think he's a...
Correct.
And people would fall over themselves to have him sponsor something if he would actually come out of his shell and do it. And 95 was your best win, I think, because you started dead last... because of a pit incident, or you had to go into the pits, and you gradually ground them down in the Marlborough 05 Commodore. Marlborough.
No, 95 was my Castro days.
Oh,
84
was
my last year of Marlborough.
Oh, it was
Peter
too.
Brock, yeah.
I've read that incorrectly. Correct. On my notes here. 84 was the Marlborough 05 side when cigarette sponsorship would actually pay for
everything.
The whole team and then some.
Everything.
Because they loved having their name of the fags
correct.
On the side of the car. Yeah,
correct.
Sorry about that. That was 84.
Yeah.
So 95 was when you...
Yeah, 95 I had... was into my third year of Castrol sponsorship. And I got my first year of Castrol sponsorship as a privateer in 93. Won Bathurst and had pole position, so I was pretty cool with that. But 95 was obviously 2 years later, and we were very competitive. Got a flat tyre before the first corner.
Yep.
The valve of the wheel was ripped out by Craig Lowndes, who moved a bit abruptly in that short 50-100 metres to the front first corner and ripped my tyre valve out. And I knew I had a flat tyre before I had done the first corner.
And shit.
And you had to go right round.
So I had to do, and this is where it comes in, that you've seen many a race car on TV, the tyre is shredding itself, flying to bits and wrecking the car.
Because they drive it too quickly.
Over too quickly, and I knew all about this, and had to talk myself into it. There's go slow, don't wreck the bloody car.
So what speed were you doing?
Oh, in speeds, I don't know, but probably never went over 80, 60 kilometres an hour.
Oh, so you travel the first lap.
I had to travel it very slowly so that...
So they got a mile in front of you, in other words.
Oh, God, they were so far ahead. Yeah, they nearly... I got within a couple of seconds of being lapped.
Fair dinkum.
By the time I pitted,
yep.
got the new tyre,
yeah.
and then for many, many laps of the race, at least the first 60 or 70 laps of the Bathurst race, I thought I was the only car in the bloody race because you could never see the rest of the field. They were on the other side of the track somewhere.
Yeah. When you gradually wore them down, the rest is history, as they say.
Yes, it was a unbelievable feeling that when you thought it, but at the same time, I got to say, it made you quite calm. I remember being very calm about it. I thought, well, if I hadn't had the flat tyre, we were at the front of the first or second row of the grid, we would have been dicing away with each other, banging each other. But in this case, I was just calm, thinking, well, I had to make every lap as fast as I possibly could. My co-driver, Russell Ingall, had to do every lap he could. The team had to perform absolutely miraculously
as
well.
What do you mean the team? What did they have to do?
We had to do pit stops for fuel and tyres. We had to do...
Brakes?
No. Well, brakes...
pads?
Brake pads. Everyone had to change brake pads, and this is another little story. And I always forget whether it was 95 or 97... But I designed my own brake calipers and got a Japanese company to make my own brake pads.
You're not a dill.
Where we didn't have to change brake pads.
Really?
So everyone's flogging around waiting for the brake pad change, where you lost about a minute.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I didn't never make a stop for brake pad change.
Is it mandatory now?
And the next year they made it mandatory. Yeah, they ganged up on me.
You made them change the rules.
They bloody ganged up on me. And
So Larry, I please, Donald, say, oh, yeah. I've driven around Bathurst, raced a car around there, but properly racing a car like you, just tell us what the exhilaration of that track is compared to other tracks you've driven on.
Well, I've been fortunate to drive on the world's best tracks in terms of the... Oh, I mentioned the old Nürburgring in Germany and...
Brands.
Brands Hatch and Silverstone and
Monaco.
Monza and all the tracks of Europe. And
Monaco?
Oh, Monaco many times. Yeah. I've won a race at Monaco.
Have you?
Yeah. I've won my Formula 3. There was the field was in heat one and heat two. Yeah. I run heat one, which got me pole position for the main race, and I had a 20-second lead with a few laps to go, and I lost concentration because I had a daily sponsor. Then he was standing on the track wanting me to slow down, and I thought, how can I slow down? I'm thinking, how can I slow down?
And why do you want you to slow down?
Because I was leading by so far.
You wanted you to be in the television footage of it.
I was in a zone that I was doing lap record after lap, and I was on the money, and my foot slipped off the brake pedal. I slipped it off. It just slipped off. And bang, like a nanosecond, hit the wall.
Shit.
And I'll never forget that time. And because, yeah, I was almost thinking about what am I going to say to Princess Carolina and all those sorts of things.
Yeah.
But it wasn't to be, yeah.
So Bathurst, tell us about...
So Bathurst, getting back to the track comparison, Bathurst is an unbelievably world-class track.
Now,
then, whenever, because...
What, now, in the past it was
as
well?
In the past, yeah. The council up there, and indeed the authorities, have shied away from making Bathurst good or safe or all the woke crap that goes on with racetracks now. Bathurst is still Bathurst as it was designed many years ago.
Yeah, but now I'm not into this. But haven't they put a different camber on some of those corners so they can fly through? They seem to go much quicker through the corners. Now, I'm not into motor car racing.
Well,
but
principally, the only change was about 20, 30 years ago when they put the Kel-Tex Chase in, and that had to happen, and I agreed with that.
That's the kink in the bottom of the straight.
Yeah, because there was a hill there. If you went
you
over
mean the back coming down into the main straight?
Yeah, the main straight of Bathurst.
Yes.
Cars, even road cars now, you get up to nearly 300k down that straightaway, and you will fly over the hill. And when you're flying, cars weren't designed to fly very well. And so there was accidents and problems there. So that was a real genuine reason to put in what's called the Kel-Tex Chase, which is a kink just before this hill.
They still go flat.
And you still get 300k down there, but you don't fly over that hill. But the rest of Bathurst, the mountainous part of the mountain, is just tremendously good.
In what way is it good?
Well, when you're going across the top of the hill, and you remember when you went through it in tourist mode, the signs are 40k speed limit, and you're doing 230 across the top of the hill before you are airborne. Slightly before you go down the hill.
Ostensibly a road.
It's just a tremendous feeling to think, hang on, this is all up to me. Don't fluck it up or you'll have a big crash here. And so it's a real challenge of judgment, as we've mentioned earlier, and so on, and faith in your machinery, faith in your tyres. Because in Bathurst being a six-hour race, there's lots of things slowly change or can quickly change on your car's behaviour.
Have you temperature, got
120 litres of fuel, maybe down to 5 litres. All these things make a difference.
Now, Larry, just before we run out of time here.
I've got more questions to ask.
I know you have, Don. But I'm going to ask just before we run out of time. You've always had it in your blood because your old man, your father, won the first Red X trial back in '56.
That's right. It's slightly wrong. There was only two Red X trials in '53 and '54. Dad went in both days in a Rover.
A Rover
75, then a Rover 90, can you believe?
Yeah, but explain what the Red X trial was, because it captures a lot of imagination.
Red X trial was a controlled race around a lap of around Australia, sponsored by the Red X company. A name that still lives today. In 55, Dad first went in a Volkswagen.
They were good cars back then, weren't they? I think they won it, didn't they?
Bob Foreman won in 55. Dad
in a Volkswagen.
Dad was second. 56, Dad won in a Volkswagen. 57, he was fourth. And 58, he won again in a Volkswagen. Always in Volkswagen. So he won two of those. They were called mobile gas trials.
Yeah.
But people still refer them to the Red X
trial.
Received
unbelievable publicity.
It
appeared in it was the Herald Sun or the Argus back then. Every day, and nothing else really went on in Australia. But this Red X trial really captured the imagination of the population, didn't it?
Tremendous crowds of people were terribly interested in it. The cars were showroom cars, effectively, and none of the big support you see today, but it was sort of a challenge that many people wanted to have a go.
The great Jack Davey, I think, had the great broadcaster Jack Davey, along with Norman Banks and Bob Dyer. But Jack Davey was an integral part of promoting that race.
He was in it, wasn't he?
Yeah, and the other guy, the Sydney radio man, John Laws, was in. I remember as a kid seeing him. I was 6 years old in the
Valvoline Oil.
He was in a Porsche. Yeah.
And a Porsche. Oh, that's
but they were driving across dirt roads, weren't they?
Hey, all roads around Australia were dirt back then.
Yeah. If Bathurst is a good track, and I respect what you say, why can't we get international racing there? Teams come out like the Formula One down here at Albert Park.
Well, Now, because as I say, there's a lot of rules about things. Formula One would be just so ridiculously fast around there. They would average 300 k's around there. It's just a huge. V8s are averaging 180 k's.
And they wouldn't allow the safety aspect for Formula One to be run around.
I mean, they go across the McPhillamy Park, in other words, the top of the Bathurst track. A Formula One wouldn't even think of lifting off. At 300 k.
What do you mean lifting off?
Lifting the throttle off. You're flat. You have your foot buried in the floor on the throttle.
Lifting off.
Well,
you take your foot off the accelerator, man. You would know what that means.
No, I don't.
Fuck me.
But a lot of people don't realise when you see a race car, whether it be Formula One, that the driver's right foot is jammed hard on that right hand pedal called the throttle, and he's on it, and you're on it. Always flat out.
It's either on the accelerator or the brake. Never cruising.
Never anything in the middle.
Now, Larry, your brother. Now, did I get this right? Your brother Gary and you invented or manufactured a called the Quiet Achiever, a solar car, a solar panel car. Is that right?
Yes, I did that with Hans Solstrop, and my brother worked for me actually a little bit,
All right.
So Hans Solstrop, who I've known for years, he's an adventurer bloke, and he rang me up at some stage and said, can we do something with solar power on a vehicle? I said, well, we can make a vehicle solar powered, can't be that hard. And so I did a bit of homework and said, well, we can... put solar panels on, we'll generate, 5 kilowatts of power or whatever. And so we got some solar cells out of BP, who then wanted to sponsor us. And when we asked BP for some money and we walked out 5 minutes later with the money, I said we didn't ask for enough. So, yes, that was 1982. I made this car. My brother, as you said, he worked for me and helped me. And we drove from Perth to Sydney. With only propulsion with solar power.
So it was successful, but was it successful?
Well, yes, because we planned to do it in 25 days and did it in 15. So that's terribly successful. And
it was successful, so it's no solar cars. No one uses them.
No.
To any great extent. Could you travel at night, incidentally, with solar, or did it store the energy?
We had battery storage, but only when the clouds went over, etc. But all we proved was that you can, with solar power, and if you don't want to go at an average speed of more than 25-30k and you're lightweight and you can't carry luggage, etc., you can do it. But it's not a big deal. But that was still over 40 years ago we did that, so... it's sort of nothing's ever new in the world, and that's just a passing phase of me wanting to do something.
Another anecdote that Larry's been involved in. Is this right? You discovered the lost cache in the Simpson Desert of some explorers in the early days in the 1905 of Barclay and McPherson. You discovered their lost cache of survival instruments. How did you discover that for a start in the Simpson Desert?
Well, after I sold my race name, I loved travelling Australia. In the course of travelling Australia, I met various people, and I met an old professor bloke once. I said, what have you been doing the last couple of months? He said, well, we were out looking for Barclay's equipment that he left in the desert in 1904.
Hang on, who's Barclay?
Barclay was an explorer who, he's not well known because he survived. if he had died, it would have been really big news. Yeah. But he survived, and his diary survived. Anyway, as time went on, I decided, and I said this story, and I'm going to go look for this thing, all these equipment, 250 kilos of equipment. So I did it all myself, went to the museum in Adelaide, found the diary, read the diary for a week in the museum, and it was in English, and I did script at school. I'm old enough to learn how to write. And he left a latitude and longitude of where he left the equipment and a list of the equipment.
God.
And I thought this...
Now, what year did he take off and what did he look?
1903, 1904. and he ran out of water. Right. So they had to unload all their gear because the camels could not walk over the hills anymore.
And
they,
whereabouts was it? Where did he...
Middle of the Simpson Desert.
Really?
400 k's northwest of Birdsville, 500 k's southeast of Alice Springs. A long, long way out. So he left this list of stuff, and I thought, this is going to be interesting. But there'd been, the historian bloke told me, there'd been 11 government searches for his equipment because the government funded some of this. They couldn't find it. So anyway, I did my homework, and I drew a spot on the map which was 120 kilometres from where he said he left it. I did a 2.5 kilometre circle, a radius. I rang my brother up, Peter, a young brother. I said, Peter, you're doing bugger all for the next couple of weeks. We'll go and look for this stuff. And I said, it's going to be up here. And that, he said, why are we going there? I said, well, it's my problem, you know. We got up there. 4 days later, we found all the equipment.
Really?
You're Larry, you're a genius, you're a mechanic, you're a discoverer, you're a star, you've had a race and an event named after you, and you are a true Australian sportsman, and we thank you, Don.
Oh, shit, finished.
We've finished.
Well, I'm going to talk to him off air, or can he come back?
Take some notes and tell us next week what he says. There's not one other thing you could ask Larry about great life. So we thank him for coming on to You Cannot Be Serious. It's been a delight. You're a good man, and we appreciate you coming in, Larry.
Thank you, Sam. Thank you, Don. My pleasure.
Well,